This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 226 was recorded on July 2nd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to healthcare workers all over the world, the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, and is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Nomura's cross-asset macro strategist, Charlie McElligott, returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss what's keeping stock prices elevated in the face of a global pandemic, treasury yields, and much, much more. We got terrific feedback on Harley Bassman's macro interview last week, but when I mentioned the possibility of Harley and Patrick going deep on options Greeks in a future postgame segment, some of you really got excited. So be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment this week when Harley Bassman, inventor of the MOVE Index, returns to talk options with Patrick. You can expect a double dose of delta hedging as Harley and Patrick antidote a severe case of theta burn, preparing themselves for the gamma flip.
All right. And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, before we even get to markets, the coronavirus cases are still on the rise, with new cases in the U.S. hitting new highs, 30% higher than they were at the peak, which most people assumed at the time was the worst of the crisis. So what's going on there?
Well, Patrick, we actually hit 51,000 new cases in a single day yesterday, July 1st, Wednesday, which was a new all-time record for new cases in the U.S. or for anywhere, for that matter. What's going on is the peak that everybody thinks of was the peak for the United States back around April 4th. That was the peak for the New York metro area. At that point, we were at about 35,000 cases per day nationally. It peaked out around that level and started declining, got back down below 20,000 cases per day. But now what we're seeing is Texas, California, and the Deep South are approaching their peaks, and those numbers are still growing in leaps and bounds daily. Goldman Sachs reports that 40% of the previously announced reopenings have already either been reversed or put on hold. You know, so I think the message here, Patrick, is learning this dance and the hammer and the dance isn't easy. A lot of people assumed we could just throw a switch and turn everything back on. And of course, predictably, that's resulting in a large increase of infections. Of course, the protests and civil unrest and so forth contributed as well. Now, this is not just the U.S., it's international as well. Australia just declared a lockdown for 1 month on the second largest state in Australia, Victoria. New cases are surging all over the world. So it's not just the civil unrest in the U.S. It's new cases all over the planet. Now, skeptics keep citing this thing saying, look, the new cases are going higher, but the death count is still trending lower. So we got nothing to worry about. I just can't believe that the same stupid people are stupid in the same way so soon after they were stupid in the same way recently. Let's go back to February, Patrick. We had the same people saying, well, but there hasn't been a single death outside of China, so there's nothing to worry about. And the smart people in the room all said, look, this thing is spreading all over the world. Obviously, the deaths lag by about a month behind the new infections. So yeah, of course, we're still trending lower on deaths. That's because infections were trending lower a month ago. And a month from now, deaths will have turned up. Inevitably, it's as obvious now as it was then, and the same people who couldn't manage to see the obvious in February are making the same stupid statements today. It just blows my mind that people can't see things that are this obvious. there's also an amazing disparity between how different countries around the globe are handling this. Now, part of the problem is the media reports the wrong statistics. They keep reporting all these countries in terms of their total infections without adjusting for the population size of that country. What we care about is per capita infections, the number of infections per million of population in a given country. Take Australia as an example, currently reporting 314 confirmed cases per million people of population. And, you know, Victoria, their second largest state, starts to look like they're showing a few more. It's not 314. I don't know what the number is, 325, 350. It's bigger than the national average. They're saying, hey, we've got to shut it down, not taking any chances with public health. At the opposite end of the spectrum, Chile in South America has almost 15,000 confirmed cases per million of population. And although they locked down the Santiago metropolitan region a couple of months ago, the rest of the country, until just 2 weeks ago, was wide open. They didn't see a need for any more lockdowns as they got going past 10,000, 11,000, 12,000, 13,000, up to, right now it's 14,800, I think. It's almost 15,000 infections per million population. That seems like they don't think it's that big of a deal, whereas Australia is freaking out over 320 confirmed cases per million population. So, and people will tell you too, well, it must be just a difference in testing. The Worldometers now is publishing both the infection counts, the number of cases per million population, and the number of tests administered per million population. So it's not just a matter of testing accounting for the difference. Meanwhile, Patrick, there are other outlier risks that could exacerbate the situation. I want to thank our listener, Alex Duncan, for calling the situation with the Three Gorges Dam in China to my attention. Now, for anyone who's not familiar with this, it's one of the biggest dams in the world. And famously, it is got so much water behind it that when they turned this dam on, when they, you know, locked it off and backed up the water behind it, that mass of water was so large that it literally slowed the Earth's rotation. So now every day is about a billionth of a second longer than it used to be just because of the existence of this dam. That's how big it is. A better way to think about how big it is more than 400 million people. That's considerably more than the entire population of the United States, live downstream of this dam, including the cities of Wuhan, Nanjing, and Shanghai. And that accounts for about 30% of China's national GDP is produced downstream of this dam. It's about 20 times bigger than the Hoover Dam in the United States, with an electrical output of 22 gigawatts. That's about 30 million horsepower, or 20 times bigger than the Hoover Dam. Now, when the Chinese government first introduced this project, it was conceived of in around 1920. It didn't actually start being built until around early 90s. And at that time, the government declared that the design was so brilliant that it was going to protect against even a 10,000-year high floodplain. Then, sometime later on, after reviewing the engineering, they updated that number quietly and changed it to every 1,000 years. Then a couple of years later, they changed it to every 100 years after starting at 10,000 years. So they're kind of downgrading their own estimates for just how strong this dam really is. It was constructed and completed in 2006. The electrical generation part went online in 2012. Already, that mountain of water behind it has moved the entire dam measurably. Now, it's only about a centimeter. It's not, you know, like it's moving feet at a time. But there have been a lot of people internationally that have questioned the structural integrity. There's a new article out this week. The headline is, "Expert says there's a risk of an imminent catastrophe at this dam." Now, that was published in a Taiwan newspaper. Taiwan relations with China are very politically heated, so it may be propaganda. So it's suspect for that reason. But a lot of people have criticized this dam. And what we do know, which is a confirmed fact, is it has a warning line about 175 meters above sea level. That's as much as the dam is designed to support. And because of torrential downpours in the area, it's several meters above that warning line right now, and it's still raining. So at least some people are saying there is a risk. Now, I have no idea, Patrick, how big that risk really is. Obviously, there may be some propaganda from Taiwan in this message. The government of China says it's absolutely no problem, but you know, we've heard that from the government of China before. If this dam suddenly let go, most of Hubei province, including the city of Wuhan, probably Nanjing and Shanghai, could be completely flooded. In fact, Wuhan was flooded with about 8 feet of water back in the 1950s. That's one of the reasons they built this dam. If it all of a sudden let go, it would flood out, you know, 30% of China's GDP. And furthermore, you'd have the province where they're fighting the virus outbreak. They're dealing with a second wave now in Hubei, you know, 6 feet deep in water. And how would that be for sanitary conditions? Now, I don't know how real this risk is. But meanwhile, on the outlier risk front, there was a gentleman in West Mongolia diagnosed with bubonic plague after eating rat meat. I guess the moral of the story is don't eat rat meat. I don't know. But if we had any of these outliers come into the equation, we could see a dramatic escalation of the problem. And even without them, Patrick, I think the market mood is, hey, the worst is clearly behind us. It's all better from here. I don't think there's any reason to assume that the worst is behind us. Look at where we thought we had peaked out on infections in the U.S. at 35,000 per day, and we had 51,000 new infections just yesterday. So nothing has peaked. There's no reason to assume that we're past the worst of this. There's no reason to assume that the second wave won't be bigger than the first wave. And there's no reason to assume that a vaccine is a certainty. I think it's maybe a 50-50. Bottom line, this thing ain't over and it's not even ending yet. But the market seems to be completely convinced and I think very much overly complacent that the worst is all behind us. We're going to finish opening the economy. Everything's going to be fine from here. Now, I do think we are going to continue to open the economy because people are unwilling to tolerate more lockdowns. That doesn't mean that the pandemic crisis is ending, and I don't think the worst of it is necessarily behind us.
Eric, let's just move on to this S&P 500 because, I mean, more or less for the last two, 3 weeks, we've been in a market correction. We had the S&P 500 hit that peak just above 3,200. And since then, we've been consolidating, but that consolidation hasn't turned into any aggressive selling. And after these job numbers today, it really looks like the market is trying to once again break out. Is it possible we're going for another leg higher here?
I think we are, Patrick, and you know, our regular listeners know that I've been struggling to understand this equity market for weeks and weeks now, and I've been saying, okay, I guess it's just expectations of more stimulus from the Fed, but I really can't put my finger on it. It doesn't make sense to me because I don't think the pandemic is over yet. Charlie McElligott in today's interview, I think, will break through my misunderstanding and clarify exactly why there are, in fact, significant catalysts for another leg to the upside. So I don't want to steal Charlie's thunder. Let's come back and talk a little bit more about equities after the feature interview.
All right, let's move on to the dollar index. And in general, the currencies really in the last month have calmed down. I mean, there was some substantial volatility in currencies back in March. And even in June, we got a bit of a move. But really, the last month has just been the dollar index bouncing around once again. Is this just a consolidation before a continuation down on the dollar? Or do you think that this could be a turn point?
Well, I certainly agree with you. We're in a sideways consolidation. There is no big news to report. There is no significant event that's happened since we talked to you last week. We would need a move above 99 or a move below 94.5 to indicate something serious in one direction or the other. As far as whether this is, you know, a resumption of a downtrend or just more consolidation before we see a reversal back to an uptrend, I think it really depends on policy outlook, you know, which central bank does the next round of accommodation before the other one does is probably going to be what drives that. So I don't really have any strong conviction in either direction.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, which also has been relatively range bound. I mean, we approached this $40 level at the start of June, and here we are a month later, and we're just more or less testing along that overhead resistance. What do you think of crude, and how did the inventory numbers come in?
Well, let's start with inventory. Crude oil drawing down 7.2 million barrels. I think that number is a little bit misleading. First of all, that would make the largest drawdown this year, and of course, drawdowns are normally bullish for price. Remember, though, that the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, is excluded from these commercial numbers. Why? Well, because that's the government's oil. It's not commercial storage. But in this environment, it really is commercial storage because the government has been leasing out space in the SPR for commercial storage. So the SPR building 1.7 million barrels, to my thinking, that really has to be subtracted from the 7.2. So you get a net commercial storage drawdown of 5.5 million barrels. That's still a big drawdown by any measure, but it's not quite 7.2. And that was coming from a previous record high in U.S. storage levels. So have we peaked, or are we going to see builds that take us to still another record high where we start getting back into risk of a storage crisis? Time will tell. I don't think this is over yet. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 293,000 barrels. I think some of that is going into the SPR, and that's where that build is coming from. Gasoline building 1.2 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 593,000 barrels. U.S. production unchanged at 11 million barrels, same as last week. Tape action, there was really only very modest upside on the news. Seemed like the market didn't really want to move too far. And, you know, as I've said, for the last several weeks, I said, watch for this rally to peak between 41 and 42, which is exactly what it did. 41 spot 63 was the peak last week. It rolled over exactly where I predicted it would, but the downside was a lot less than I expected. We only went down just a few dollars, and we seem to really be recovering now. And I note that this afternoon's close on Thursday for both RBOB gasoline and for WTI crude oil, we're on highs of the day, and RBOB gasoline is often an early tell for what's to come in the crude oil market. So, to my thinking, the virus data is still really clearly telling us that we have moved into a new period. I don't know if you want to call it a second wave or a resumption of the first wave. Call it what you will, but cases are rapidly increasing. We're learning that it's not as easy as people thought to just start the economy back up again without adverse consequences. And I'm sure that the death rate will turn back up after a lag time passes from the increase in cases. So I don't know why all of this optimism is there, but from a technical standpoint, if I look at the tape, it looks like the correction is ending and we're seeing more upside. We haven't quite gotten a breakout past last week's high, but we are, as we're speaking now, you know, we hit almost $41 this afternoon, coming off of that a little bit now at about just below 40 and a half. Still, you know, looks like the market, it's closing well above its short-term moving averages. Looks like it wants to trade higher. I just don't know why.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because back on Tuesday, we got the big headline, 1800 printed on gold. It was everywhere, but gold never really followed through. We're still on the futures trading just under 1800, around 1790 as we're recording this. Does this trend continue here on gold? Are we going to see that test of that all-time high?
Well, as you say, Patrick, I think we really have to emphasize, because there's so much, frankly, exaggerated reporting that you see on the internet, gold really hasn't broken out to the upside quite yet. It sure looks like it wants to. It's on the cusp of that. I think there's a very strong likelihood that it will. And in the interest of full disclosure, I did add to my gold positions at 1780 on the dip here below 1800. Obviously, I wish I'd done that at 1680 a month ago when I had the chance to, but I wasn't expecting this breakout. Now, the breakout hasn't really been confirmed yet, but it looks to me like that's really what the market wants to do. We need to see a daily close above 1800 and then have it stay there for several days. We got the daily close above 1800 or right on 1800 exactly once, and it was down the next day. You know, we're not quite there yet, but it looks to me like we're bouncing off of that little reaction down to 1780, and I'm optimistic that we may be on the verge of a breakout. Let's see what next week brings.
All right, let's leave it with touching on that 10-year treasury yield. I mean, I've been talking about a breakdown in the yield being a, some sort of like canary in the coal mine. But really, in the last few days, we saw yields slowly gravitating back to 70 basis points. And a lot of people starting to ask the question as to whether yields will start heading back up from here. Do you have any bias as to what's happening?
I really don't. No change in my view. I don't have any short-term view. I'm focused on the long-term picture. And, of course, Charlie is one of the people that I'm really looking forward to asking about where we're headed in the long term.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Nomura Securities cross-asset macro strategist Charlie McElligott. Now, why did we invite Charlie back as this week's guest?
Well, Charlie has a lot of insight into what's going on beneath the surface, what some of the effects of different market participants and the way that their systematic model-driven trading systems drive the market. And that really turned out to be key. I didn't know this when we scheduled him, but I was looking for, okay, who can explain to me what the heck is going on? Why is the stock market just so much stronger than I think it should be given the news flow about the coronavirus situation? Well, Charlie's going to provide that answer in this interview, and I think he's hit it brilliantly. Let's talk a little bit more about it, but we'll save the rest until after the interview. Before we get into the interview, folks, I want to remind you it would sure help us out if you could rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or on iTunes. A couple of you pointed out that our instructions for how to do so were not as complete as they could have been, so there's new upgraded instructions, step-by-step, telling you exactly what to do in order to rate and review us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. And likewise, if you use some other system, whether it's Spotify or whatever, to listen to Macro Voices, we'd certainly appreciate your ratings and reviews on those other services as well. The instructions for Apple Podcasts and iTunes are in your Research Roundup email. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Charlie is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Charlie McElligott, Nomura's cross-asset macro strategist. Charlie prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. I strongly encourage you to download it, as we will be referring to the charts and graphs that it contains throughout today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage and look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads, just above Charlie's picture. Charlie, it's great to have you back on the show. I recognize some of these charts and graphs because I so enjoy your daily letter. And I see that some of these charts and graphs in today's deck came from this morning's letter. I want to start, though, before we dive into the slide deck, with the big picture, which is, boy, we are facing one of the most difficult natural crises in generations. We've got a global pandemic threatening the entire world. It looked like maybe the worst of the first wave was behind us, but in the last week or so, we've seen a major escalation in the case counts around the world. Texas and California and the Deep South are all experiencing a great big resurgence in cases. And that's international, too. Victoria, Australia just announced a lockdown. Chile has just a massive, massive growth in their cases. A lot of countries really getting into trouble. Stock market, not quite back to all-time highs, but, you know, really looking strong here. How the heck do you reconcile that? A lot of people are saying it's expectations of more central bank stimulus. Does that explain the whole story, or is there more to the picture?
It's great to be back. You guys have been fantastic supporters, so we appreciate the chance to be here again. Look, I think coming out of that initial, because we're calling all parts of this experience phases, that March-April period, February-March-April period, you know, I think when speaking with, you know, clients over that period of time, they started kind of making a checklist when you had the sentiment shock down, which, as we've spoken about so many times and I talk about in the daily, you know, you get a macro shockdown catalyst, you get, you know, those prior kind of short vol positions in the market that get disrupted, you have prices move through dealer gamma levels. Dealer gamma levels often coincide with trend and systematic vol control, deleveraging levels, and you get these, you know, shockdowns, and then you get a shock up once vol gets you know, rich enough and attractive enough to sell, and you get intervention through central bankers and authorities. And, you know, look, without question, the actions of the Fed and politicians around the world, central banks around the world, were a huge part of allowing folks to get, you know, to feel supported, to feel like they could begin to get constructive again. And the kind of generic playbook of that period was, okay, well, let's start seeing the curve flatten with regards to case growth. Let's get some constructive, positive feedback with regards to, you know, vaccine trials. Remdesivir, you know, in particular was a notable kind of market sentiment swing. Obviously, the liquidity operations from central banks were a big part of the deal. The truly unprecedented asset purchases, you know, with regards to certainly just looking at the Fed as microcosm, you know, outright buying of risk assets. All of those things were part of that market turn in that first phase one. Everybody in the world has been anticipating that you were going to get a phase two with regards to a resurgence. I think what a lot of people are realizing now is that has kind of come to fruition over these last few weeks, is that one, it's probably the phase one. It's just the extension as it pushes into the country. I think right now, and this is very tactical and very recent, within the last week, some of the stuff that we're getting from clients is that you're seeing actually some really optimistic interpretations of some very new data as it pertains to the virus. And, you know, I will never claim to be an immunologist or an infectious diseases expert, but, you know, speaking with clients who are paying experts to have these conversations, you know, something that has really happened, what so much of the public focus is on the bearish headline sentiment of the case growth. The equities tape over the last week or two is no longer responding to those, you know, new case record in Arizona or Texas or California. Instead, there's two really interesting points, and I'll get granular into these before we turn away. But, you know, outside of the U.S., so particularly in like northern Italy and China, there is some focus being paid to hospital studies from infectious disease teams that are showing that the type of COVID patients that they're seeing now are very different from the ones they were seeing 3 months ago. And that particularly speaks to much lower viral loads and fatality rates down significantly, down, you know, 50% in some cases, which speaks to this potential of a mutation. You know, viral swabs now giving soft positives, weak amounts of the virus versus that of phase one. That is something that a lot of people in the market are really clinging to right now, and that makes a lot of sense. That would be a significant development. The other is more U.S.-centric because China and Italy were kind of you know, ahead of us. We lagged them with regards to the growth of the pandemic. The others in the U.S. is the early data out of Texas, Florida, Arizona, California, you know, in particular. Those are all showing the ages where the case growth is mostly concentrated in is actually downshifted to the young, so like 18 to 49, which could go hand in hand with the steady to low hospitalization rates and the still declining mortality rates, despite the case growth trajectory. So I think both of those scenarios are leading to this belief that the virus had initial success, which, you know, is a really crude way of saying it was most deadly with those who were the most vulnerable, you know, a culling of the herd, basically. And that sets up a less bad next phase, especially when taken into context with politicians on both sides of the aisle acknowledging that they will not go back to a full stop quarantine unless things really devolve from here. And that, I think, is keeping us static and steady higher, as opposed to the headline trajectory of the case growth, which looks worse and worse.
Okay, Charlie, so to summarize all of that, it sounds like we've got reason to think that even though the case growth really is getting worse and continuing to get worse, maybe it's happening in a younger demographic that's more able to tolerate those infections, go back to work, continue to open the economy. As you say, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, it seems very clear now that government officials and public sentiment are leaning toward reopening the economy. Good, bad, or indifferent, that's what they're going to do. And it sounds like you think the market is mostly discounting that kind of outcome. How does that match up with what you're seeing in some of the both the CTA positioning and the various other things that you guys watch on a more tactical level as we get into the slide deck?
So I would say this, you know, as that, you know, phase one recovery off the March lows and the extreme overshoot of negative sentiment and, you know, pricing in depressionary type, you know, type of outcomes, which were warranted to a certain extent, even though this, you know, some would say that this situation parallels more of an almost like a natural disaster in some ways, which could change the kind of the trajectory or shape of the curve on the comeback. Once you have that initial volatility spike, and this is what we just touched on earlier, and you get the interventions from, you know, the authorities, and in this particular case, what really mattered was not just, again, the unprecedented monetary expansion, but what really needed to happen, and we've talked about this for years with regards to kind of shaking the lazy, you know, perpetual skepticism or cynicism around the idea of inflation or above trend growth and above trend inflation, was that you needed to see fiscal stimulus. And the fiscal stimulus is a really big deal, right? The fiscal stimulus is a kind of a tiebreaker that's never before been experienced anywhere close to this magnitude, as authorities kind of pulled out all the stops to stimulate future growth. So, you know, I bring that up before I talk about CTAs, because that has led to, after this initial shockdown, rich ball data, you know, collapsing with the extent and the scale of the misses, what that does too is it sets up an incredibly low bar with regards to beats on the reopen. And the velocity of the beats on the reopen was even more high beta in some senses because of the itchy trigger fingers from, you know, the administration to get things reopened in the United States. Obviously, there's, you know, potential downside to that, I think we're feeling right now. But that same shock down merited and elicited an even larger, you know, shock up type of recovery. So, you know, as far as the slides go, I'd actually skip ahead to slide three, the Economic Surprise Index, which, you know, simply put, is a kind of sort of standard deviation of the average U.S. economic data result. And in this case, you know, if you're just think about it, assigning a positive one for a beat versus estimate to zero for an inline and a negative one for a miss. You know, what you're seeing here is that, you know, right now the index is just printed at an all-time high, which speaks to the magnitude and the consistency and the scale of these beats that are coming in off of the shock lows. And that sort of impulse turn in sentiment, impulse turn in growth, impulse turn with regards to potential expectations, future expectations for inflation, which has a lot more data points, that really forced a macro regime shock that was felt in the vol space. So, you know, to go then back to slide one, what you see here, you know, in the bond space, it still is reflecting, and that's almost, you know, consensual longs across the boards. Certainly, if you look that fourth column in, that's the 1 month ago in parentheses, and still now to the today, the first column in, you know, you're getting a lot of kind of max long signal across the bond complex, which is capturing certainly the environment of you know, this last kind of, you know, 3 months of shock down. My thought here, though, is that in conjunction with a pretty upbeat view on what vol can do as far as kind of resetting and shocking out some of this legacy positioning, you know, it matters then when we're talking about that bond long and the impact that it's had on equity behavior and equity thematic behavior on, you know, the volatility complex, that, you know, I do feel like there is a potential for this very large bond position to just reprice even on incrementally better interpretation of the virus data. Over the next 2 to 3 weeks, let's say, we're not seeing those hospitalization rates spike in conjunction with the case growth. We're not seeing the mortality rates move off the lows. Some of this premium that's been built into longs in the bond space, you know, as you see in slide one with the CPA positioning, you know, giving that 100% long signal and most of the major G10 developed market bonds and you know, short-term money markets, you know, euro dollar futures, for instance, you know, some of that could bleed out into a less bad scenario. That's an additional slingshot for equities.
So, Charlie, when you talk about a slingshot for equity markets, I assume you mean an upside catalyst from here. But it's interesting. If I look at slide six, where you've got your CTA position estimates, not for bonds, but for equities, it looks like we had positive positioning on equities a week ago and a month ago. But as of today and yesterday, it's showing negative, as I see it, on S&P and Russell. So what's going on there, and what do you expect?
Sure. So you know, those that far left column, the signal today, right? To be crystal clear to listeners at home, that's actually through Tuesday morning. And what is important there is that if you then skip over to that green box level to buy, we triggered through those cover levels in the S&P, which is now back at 100% long. You know, if you take into context this whole time horizon, right, the fourth column in was 1 month ago, the third column 1 week ago, you see that obviously this new case growth, oh, here goes phase two, here we go again, they're going to have to unwind the reopening, that got picked up with regards to, you know, much of the global equities futures that we track in our basket have maintained this short framework, this short signal throughout this experience, because again, the move down was just so powerful. The fact of the matter was, though, a month ago, you know, certainly due to the velocity of the U.S. recovery, the S&P and NASDAQ, you know, were both 100% long. In the Russell, which was a, you know, obviously very economically sensitive small cap, very high beta, very financial centric, yield sensitive, that had even trimmed its short to capture some of that rally off the lows. The last kind of 1 week period, you know, shows this shifting back to a short, which is picking up that case growth fear. The news here, though, is that as of today, which is not updated in the slide, but that S&P position is back 100%, and it now makes that the S&P and the NASDAQ are the only two longs across the equities portfolio of 13 different global futures, while 11 are still short. And to me, if you get this less bad behavior in the fixed income market, this less bad interpretation of the virus, the less bad interpretation of pricing in a, you know, a potential re-shutdown, you're going to get a yields up trade. You're going to get probably a bear steepening trade. And the bear steepening really matters for equities behavior, because then if you go back to, say, slide two, this is now picking up what's been happening over the last quarter in agitation, right? Everybody in the world has been, I've made a career out of talking about value versus growth. What is in U.S. factors, U.S. equities factors. Value, what has become value is basically, you know, the stuff that is cheap, it's going long the stuff that's cheap and being short the stuff that's expensive. Well, is it any wonder then that for well over 10 years, certainly since the financial crisis and even a little bit before that, value has been destroyed. Value has been destroyed because investors have been willing to pay for growth at any price, right? And growth at any price meant stuff that can grow profits or grow earnings regardless of the economic cycle. So stuff like secular growth tech, right? The high flyers in tech, NASDAQ, you know, those types of names have just gotten more and more crowded, and they become bond proxies, right? They end up trading, they need low yields to justify their expensive valuations. They look like bonds, they've benefited from this massive bond bull market, and that's where people have been hidden. So what was a pure momentum portfolio was basically long growth, short value. When you look then at that slide two and see that quarter to date column, you know, second from the right, it shows you that there's been a real agitation going on, you know, not just in equities factors, but, you know, from a cross asset perspective, which is picking up a real agitation, a real regime change with regards to what people are thinking about going forward. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, that's what a dual left tail shock does to markets. You know, when we got, it wasn't just the pandemic in March, but it was also the crude price war. And the crude price war, which had an added kicker, of course, to the global growth picture and, you know, gasoline consumption and oil consumption and things like that. But when you see previously left for dead value, which is all the deeply cyclical, economically sensitive stuff that people have made perpetual underweights and shorts, really starting to rip and outperform the secular growth stuff that people have been crowded into for a long time, you know, it's telling you that something important is going on. And it hasn't just been, you know, an equities phenomenon. Cross asset momentum was down kind of 6% last quarter. Multi-asset trend was down 4.5%, which is, and just equities momentum, as you see here, was down almost 23% on the quarter. So that to me is a signal that we are in the midst of a turn.
Okay, Charlie. So big picture wise, it seems like we've got some upside catalysts that could be constructive for equities. But I want to touch on another topic, because a lot of the work that you guys have done at Nomura has been analyzing the impact of the short vol trade and all of the volatility strategies in the marketplace. You've done a lot of work in your dailies just talking about where the gamma flip levels are in different asset classes, where options driven buying and selling comes into play and so forth. What does the whole vol complex tell you? Does it contribute to this this constructive story for equities, or does it potentially suggest that maybe there's another side of the story?
So that is very much our bread and butter. You know, I'm blessed to work on the best equity vol desk on the street, which really provides me an incredible look under the hood at, you know, the market forces which matter most. And I've, you know, longtime readers or clients know that I believe that you know, gamma is the largest force in the market, and you know, all of that is you know, that's a subheader under just the general vol space, right? And as it relates to the shock of the past 3 to 4 month window, you know, this most recent quarter that just ended, you know, vol has remained sticky and high, largely because not a lot of discretionary fundamental buy side investors have the willingness or VAR capacity after that type of a vol shock to be able to short vol again. You know, we've spoken ad nauseum about the kind of the perverse market structure has been created since the financial crisis response and the Fed put, and you know, the creating of volatility as an asset class as a yield enhancement strategy in a world without yield. That has incentivized former buyers of volatility, you know, real money, asset liability managers like pension funds, insurance companies. They used to buy hedges, now they sell volatility, right? And that's created this, you know, tail wagging the dog phenomenon where, you know, the vol dictates to the underlying asset class. You know, when your VAR limits are based off of kind of trailing realized windows, and we just went through a generational volatility shock, you've had this dynamic where people haven't really been able to do as much short vol as their kind of models would tell them they would like to be doing. What is happening though, and you know, discretionary investors are sitting there watching this kind of, you know, headline sentiment ping pong on case growth, a lot of vol sensitive systematic strategies have been reallocating into equities exposure, or, you know, covering their shorts of the past 3 months, as we just kind of went over in the CTA you know, the CTA look at the, you know, the 13 equities futures that we track in the model, you know, 11 of which remain short. And what you're seeing is price and vol signals are beginning to turn. So like, this is actually, you know, I always, people, this makes so much rational sense to folks, but they don't think about it all the time. But, you know, let's look at what's just happened over this past 3 months. It is really important to realize that, you know, short-term trailing realized volatility has begun to collapse unto itself, right? So, you know, as of kind of yesterday, S&P 60-day realized was at 65 on May 18th, right? So like a month and a half ago. And it's currently, you know, let's say 27, 28, something like that. You know, S&P 10-day realized vol went from, you know, 41 2 weeks ago to now low 20s in an even shorter window. So the velocity of that repricing lower of volatility really, really matters, especially then as it pertains to a trend or a vol control model, which uses volatility as the exposure toggle. So like, if you think back about that 60-day window, right, 3 month, 60-day window, over the past 2 weeks, something really important has occurred. And that's that much of the worst of March days, all those shock down days, have dropped out of that 60-day window, right? You had like an S&P down 7.6%, a down 4.9%, a down 4%, a down 9.5%, a down 12%, a down 5.5% day, et cetera, that are now no longer part of that, you know, 3 month window. So if you're talking about like a vol control strategy, and our model looks at either the max of the 1 month realized or 3 month realized vol, and then sets a 10% allocation target, it's a really big deal, because as in the post vol spike surge, these types of strategies, you know, this could look like a variable annuity product sold from a kind of a sleepy, you know, insurance company or, you know, asset manager, liquidated their equities exposure to what was like 0th percentile allocation 3 months ago. Now they have a ton of room to add. So, you know, looking at slide 4, if you look at that lower right-hand box, and these are just some of our very baseline estimates of kind of the implied notional allocation into the equities space in particular, you know, you see that, and this is just historical context, kind of looking back, you know, 3 years, but from peak of January, you almost had a sell of $400 billion of implied notional equities, which is just now beginning to grind back. That green box in the middle there is looking at hypothetical one-day changes, 3% up 2% band, we're adding anywhere from like $1 billion to $2 billion a day. In this particular day, you know, which is a snapshot of yesterday, we estimated an add of $2 billion of equities exposure. If you then actually skip ahead to page 5, where we run just, you know, based on kind of these simple calculations, you know, an implied change for tomorrow or today plus tomorrow, you see in those green boxes at the top, you know, these $2 billion to $4 billions all begin to add up. If we were talking about an average daily market move of 0%, you know, looking out over 1 week, that would be almost another $7 billion to add. If the market was going nowhere at all for the next 1 month, that's almost $40 billion to add. And again, the lower left box, you'll see this in the, you know, it's highlighted in red, the equities allocation on a 10-year look back is still only, you know, a 6th percentile. Right. But you look and see how much has been bought back over the last 3 months in the box next to that, the green highlight. You know, the last 3 months, you're talking about $53.5 billion of equities exposure added back. You know, over the last 2 weeks, that's $18 billion in and of itself. So this is mechanical. This is unemotional. And if you look and see that even on a day where, you know, market's not doing much today, you know, kind of flattish S&Ps. VIX is continuing to trade under pressure, and that is also another slingshot for this whole space of the universe, you know, vol control funds, CTA funds, that have taken down their exposure so low. Again, going back to, you know, that CTA estimate on page 6, that's a lot of short base out there that is actually off the extreme. We also estimate that aggregate short, max short notional position was to almost negative 400 at the peak of the short. Now you're just back to flat. There is still a lot of room to cover. And frankly, at this point, you're much closer to the cover levels than the additional sell levels. And that's why I still think there is ample room to see the systematic universe as vol rebases to continue adding exposure. And you know, ultimately, then you look at a slide like page 7, where you just look at S&P futures positioning. The orange lines are leveraged funds per the CFTC TFF data. You just see in those little green highlight boxes, just last week, you saw these tectonic covers out of that universe. So like the 1 week purchase from leveraged funds, from hedge funds in US equities futures was almost $24 billion in total across S&P, NASDAQ, and Russell. That's a 100th percentile 1 week buy to cover in NASDAQ futures at $5 billion. $16 billion of that was S&P. That's a 99th percentile, you know, 1 week buy to cover. So there is still ample kind of fuel to burn on a melt up, which is obviously frustrating a fundamental investor base who remained, you know, skeptical, you know, with regards to the kind of the trajectory of the rally in conjunction or weighed against, you know, the economic outlook, the behavioral change of people, the spending changes of people that, you know, frankly caught them wrong footed. Because as soon as vol begins to reprice lower in this case, and we saw this into the last options expiration, you know, systematic overriders do begin to dip their toe back in the water and they start selling options again because their models say this vol is rich and you're long the underlying, collect a little extra premium. That develops unto itself and can start to snowball. And thus you've seen this big systematic reallocation, even just to get back to a very low total amount of exposure with still a lot of room to add.
Charlie, I just want to summarize for the benefit of some of our listeners who don't have professional experience with these vol targeting strategies. The gist of what we're saying here is a whole lot of the institutional investor universe makes their buying and selling decisions and their equity allocations not based on emotions and gut feelings, but based on computer-driven models that are really driven by volatility in the marketplace. And one of the reasons that we had those massive down days in March, where there were 7 or 8% in a single day of downside in the S&P, is because those models were telling those institutional investors, sell. And they don't think about it. They don't get emotional. They just do what their model tells them. What we're seeing now is those models are basically sending the message, all systems are green to buy equities. It's time to get back in the market because whatever happened to upset volatility is behind us now. Is that the gist of it?
It really is. I mean, at the end of the day, anything vol control, vol target, you know, trend, you know, purely speaking systematically, is going to size each position set to be inversely proportional to the instrument's volatility. So as volatility goes lower, that position sizing can then, you know, reverse and go higher. And if you're thinking about, you know, back to that slide about just the velocity of the data beats, which is a macro input and, you know, certainly into, you know, a number of models. It's not all just price or vol, but, or even just the idea of impulse, an impulse turn, a change of change, or the rate of change with vol, with price, with an economic data impulse, you know, has a profound effect on these first mover, short-term types of strategies. The other point I would make, however, is that, and this is where we get so much of this crowding and amplification, certainly over the past decade, while we crash down and then we crash up, is that although a lot of the systematic strategies might be the first movers, that the entire professional investor universe is, in my mind, basically a momentum trader themselves. And that is because of the same dynamic. All of their VAR models, all of their risk management tools are still, frankly, at the end of the day, operating on that same framework. When you get a vol spike, you get a gross down, right? Again, the size of each position is set to be inversely proportional to the instrument's volatility. And so you end up having like this amplification effect where everybody is a momentum trader. Everybody is a trend trader. And unfortunately, if you were, you know, rear view mirror driving, you know, some of these crashes, as a fund, you would prefer to be deploying cash into the crashes. Instead, what ends up happening is that you're forced to delever and gross down into the crashes, and then you lever up into the rallies to match your exposure or volatility targets. It's quite perverse. I don't see that changing as long as, you know, frankly, central banks continue to backstop the market with their kind of unspoken financial conditions mandate.
The point in any case is that right now what these messages are telling institutional investors is all indications are green. Challenger, you are go for throttle up. Guess what? That particular example didn't work out too well for the Challenger crew. So I'll express my own skepticism about relying too much on these computer models. But that's what is driving a lot of the institutional trade, and it makes a lot of sense to explain the tape action that we're seeing. And as you say, it sounds like a setup for more upside in equities from here. Charlie, I want to take a big step back now. We've talked about the big picture in equities, and we also talked about shorter term where some of the CTA positioning is in bonds. But let's talk about the big picture in bonds. You know, we've had almost a 40-year bond bull market, and I'm going to say it's taken us all the way down to zero yield in the 10-year. Of course, we really only got down to whatever the low was, 30 basis points or something. When you're coming from 1,500 basis points in the early 80s, I'm going to call 30 basis points close enough to zero that we pretty much got to the end of the road. And I guess my question is, you know, is it really an end of the road, or is zero just a stop along the way to negative rates? Do we have a secular end of a 40-year event in the bond market, or is it way too early to call that? How do you see the big picture for the whole bond market story?
Look, I'm skeptical. I continue to be skeptical of this long-term, you know, secular shift. I don't see a world of sustainable above-trend inflation, you know, and thus a reversal of the, you know, multi-decade bond bull market. You know, somewhat going back to the issue that the Fed encountered, and they still have clearly a ton of scar tissue from in 2018, their own financial conditions mandate and the amount of leverage in the market, in the financial system, doesn't allow them to let rates move higher and move in their face, despite a personal view that low interest rates are actually part of the problem because they don't force productive investment decisions, you know, from an individual or a corporate level. You know, they tried and they should have let it run longer, but actually just paused and been more responsive to the market instead of so tone deaf in 2018. To try to normalize the balance sheet and let, you know, the policy rate normalize. And we tantrumed, right? We tantrumed in 2013 as well at the mere mention, right? Jerome Powell got the joke back then, right? The October 12 Fed minutes have him on the record as speaking and knowing that the Fed is running a massive, you know, quote, short volatility position, and that the market will continue wanting more and continue pressing more. I think that in and of itself will never allow for, you know, a true end to the bond bull market. I do think, and also too, long term, I believe that, you know, the three Ds, right? You know, the long term disinflationary implications of debt, of demographics, and of tech disruption. Those are major headwinds. Clearly, a short term fiscal stimulus impulse is a big deal, though, from a tactical perspective. And, you know, Germany last month, within this last month, capitulating finally with regards to both domestic fiscal stimulus and more importantly, with regards to the Eurozone and the Eurozone economy, with regards to coronavirus bonds and debt mutualization, is a huge deal, right? They've just been an empty socket for, you know, decade plus with regards to the global growth picture. That matters, right? You know, China continues to do a lot of stuff. Not as much, you know, you're with a mix of fiscal and quantitative. And obviously, U.S., and this is going to be a big future input to the election, or the election, frankly, I guess, is going to be a big future input to the direction of bonds. You know, what's happening here with regards to our own fiscal stimulus and, you know, the potentials for, you know, a democratic takeover, speaking to universal living wages and things like that. I think that there is potential in fits and starts to have the legacy, decade-long, everything duration, slowflation, Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, positioning occasionally gets shocked out, right? We have crises, you know, a few times a year. When growth is kind of 2% in GDP for much of the last decade and core CPI is sub 2%, it allows them to keep rates really easy, policy pretty easy. And that incentivizes fixed income longs, and that incentivizes longs and fixed income lookalikes and equities like tech, as well as things like utilities. And then you short stuff that's economically sensitive like cyclicals. When you have these periods of overshoot on the negativity around a crisis and you get some less bad data, or you get an actual inflationary impulse due to a big tax cut, due to a big, you know, money distribution, whatever that might be, you're going to have these positioning shocks and unwinds. And I think that in light of some of this positioning dynamic, and again, you can see on page 8 there, just looking at CTA kind of exposures, with the equities position just kind of an 18 percentile going back to 2011, or bonds 98th percentile, this is where you start getting some of those extremes that can sharply reverse. And again, since I even started talking about this, you know, 3 days ago with clients, S&P's up 130 points, Treasuries 10 years sold off almost 8 bips, and front VIX future is down 5 vol points. You know, like, I think all of this setup is out there. You get these sharp adjustments, and then you kind of go back. As it pertains, what could maybe turn some of this investor cynicism, you know, and what I call the siren song of inflation, there is a little bit more of a credible case to be made with regards to inflation right now. And that is, you know, the German capitulation away from austerity and fiscal stimulus there, the potential for a U.S. New stimulus package, where I think, you know, an increasingly desperate President Trump is going to be forced to move closer to the Pelosi $3 trillion kind and away from the GOP's $1 trillion kind. Obviously, the potential for a Democratic sweep where the Senate is potentially in play when and look for even more, a larger government spending trajectory going forward, or permanent fiscal stimulus is going to matter. And obviously, like, supply chain disruptions from COVID and global trade breakdown, tight inventories, all those types of things matter. And then finally, you know, the Fed and central banks globally, where just the monetary expansion with money supply and reserve balances, credit creation as companies draw down on their revolvers, you know, that's fodder to get yourself more rebalanced. And frankly, at the end of the day, when you take it back to some of the things I talked about at the start, where just trend and momentum strategies have just stopped working, that's what this is capturing. Investors are realizing they were probably too far set up into too long of a bond position. They got to start taking down some of that bond exposure. And occasionally, with, you know, a core CPI beat or a big jobs beat, when nobody knows how to estimate the jobs numbers that make growth look like it's a little bit better than maybe we expected, you can get these shock downs, these positioning shock downs. And I think that's probably where we are right now.
Charlie, we've got huge civil unrest across the country. There has been a lot of talk about this potentially growing into, you know, the culminating, if you will, with the election. And something I've been starting to follow is a lot of analysts are saying, hey, look, there's almost no way you could have a normal November 3rd. You know, we find out the evening of Election Day, you know, who the winner is, because we know there's going to be a lot of mail-in ballots. We're not sure exactly how much yet, but that stuff's going to have to be counted. So unless it's an outright sweep where it's just super clear who won, it's very likely that we don't find out on election night, and it's also likely that any election result, if it's at all close, is going to be contested by whoever didn't win. And, you know, that's going to create some more turbulence and probably a lot of escalation of that civil unrest. People, you know, half the country is going to be very upset with the election outcome, whatever it is. How do you guys at Nomura think about that and model that into your thinking about markets?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, on the equity vol side, you have a kink out, you know, around that election period, as there should be. You know, a lot of clients over the past, say, month and a half, as the unrest was materializing, which, you know, where there was an element of the COVID anger built into that as well. So there was a little bit of a multiplier there, but you saw people doing a lot of calendar trades in vol, you know, selling some near-term stuff to fund, you know, fund some stuff out around that election period, December type of vol, long vol trades, just to kind of pay for the purchase of the long vol stuff. You know, it still looks underpriced to us because of some of what you're talking about. I think the civil unrest stuff, between now and then, which is an almost certainty, between now and then, meaning the election, is going to matter because it's going to continue to impact election odds. And, you know, maybe overly simplistic, and we have to make generalizations here, but the general kind of playbook here is that, you know, certainly in the case of, say, a blue sweep, where, you know, Dems have the House, they take the White House, and then, you know, potentially better odds to take the Senate than we've seen in quite some time. There is a train of thought that says this: look, it's going to be a large capital outflow dynamic in the United States, right? It's a potential dollar shock type of a trade due to this idea that higher corporate and individual tax rates and the loss of this kind of U.S. tax haven status since the tax cuts of the past 4 years, if those were to roll off and potentially get even more punitive, which, you know, more punitive than they were before, is a growth shock. It's a corporate problem. It's a consumer spending shock. You know, that is a large part of that thinking that leads most to believe that current straddles around the election aren't pricing in a big enough move. I think that there's probably a more nuanced spin to that as to why it's not as big of a vol gap, even though it is, you know, certainly kinked out there, which is that, look, you know, some of the swing state senators that might be tilting blue are actually more middle of the road types that will be, or more moderate types that will push back on, you know, substantial tax hikes. And, you know, I think that, so the thought then is that you get that blue sweep scenario, which, again, to line up all three of those things is, you know, is like hitting a trifecta. It's sounds easy. It's not easy to execute, though. That is a trade that I think people think the market gets shocked down and gets bought probably off the back of that. You know, the other thing I would add, Eric, is that there is also a view that around that kind of shock down, if the market were to go vigilante, the Fed stands ready. And if you don't think that the mechanical processes that have been worked out over the course of the past month, with the Fed now being a top five holder in many credit ETFs, you know, it was a test drive for equities purchases, you're wrong. I do think that a lot of that logistical workflow has been dealt with. There have even been kind of workarounds with regards to the language of the vehicle, of the special purpose vehicle that's doing the purchases, that potentially could create the workaround that previously made it something that needed to go to vote or law changed with regards to purchasing equities. I think those thoughts are out there. And also part of that is the potential, not just, you know, something kind of passive like yield curve control, which the Fed has discussed, which means it's been discussed, but have said no for now. But certainly too, you know, in a real doomsday plan, say, you know, the market tantruming after a blue sweep, plus a more, you know, COVID stickiness out there, and a lot of parents rushing their kids to the emergency room in the fall around the election time because they have a sniffle. You know, if we're really tense, it wouldn't take as much, and certainly I'd say it's a non-zero potential that, you know, you could have a big enough shock where the Fed would do the seeming inevitable and you know, do negative rates. That's, you know, it's not a high probability scenario. It would require a tremendous financial condition shock, but it's non-zero.
Well, Charlie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. I've also become a huge fan of your daily letter. Listeners, for anyone not familiar, all of the charts in today's slide deck came out of just one day's worth of Charlie's daily newsletter. In fact, everything in today's slide deck came out of Wednesday's letter. That letter is available free of charge to institutional investors who are clients of Nomura Securities. Please don't blame Charlie. It's not his fault. Regulators and his employers control who can get that. So you've got to be an institutional investor and have a relationship with Nomura. If you have that relationship, you are crazy if you have not yet contacted your Nomura rep and asked to be added to the distribution list for Charlie's excellent letter. Charlie, I can't thank you enough. We look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was so great to have Charlie back on the show. You know, it's so important to be able to reflect on liquidity versus fundamentals, because we can always look at the fundamental circumstances as to why the market shouldn't be up. But there's a lot of reasons the way money is allocated and how the allocations are calculated and all the quant stuff that drives the flow of money. And to be able to understand the intermediate to short-term flow, you have to understand all these little nuances. And Charlie is just so good at getting a pulse on that. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, for me, this was just a light bulb moment for me, because I've been so frustrated to understand why is the stock market so strong when, as far as I interpret the virus news, it shouldn't be. And I think the answer is because a whole lot of institutional traders, it's not that they're misinterpreting the virus news, it's that they're not interpreting it at all. They make their equity allocations based on volatility targeting models. Those volatility targeting models have dropped out of their backward-looking period. They've dropped those February dates where we saw the huge volatility swings in the S&P because of headlines coming out about the coronavirus crisis. That's the reason that they're rebuilding their long equity positions. It makes perfect sense, and I agree with Charlie that that could be a catalyst to take the market another leg higher from here. What I question, though, is at some point, maybe when we get the inevitable, easily foreseeable turn up, not only in case count, but also in death count, and we get more states being forced to reverse their reopening plans and extending lockdowns and shut-ins and so forth, maybe at that point we get another round of those headlines that take us back down significantly. And of course, at that point, the road has been paved for a new round of de-risking, because those same volatility models would turn back up if there was headline-induced selling that would potentially cause the volatility targeting traders to de-risk in reaction to that, and now you get a reflexive, big, exaggerated down move again. So I reemphasize that this thing ain't over until it's over, and it's not over, but a leg up in the short term until that headline news is staring the market in the face to the point where it's just too much to ignore, that makes perfect sense, and it seems to be what's happening. So I think it explains a lot. In any case, Patrick, we've gotten a lot of listener feedback saying they would love to hear your take on what questions you would have asked Harley Bassman last week. So we've got Harley back rejoining us this week. I'm going to leave it to you guys to talk options, because some of it's over my head. So Patrick and Harley, take it away.
So joining us here in the post game is Harley Bassman. Harley, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, it's only been a few weeks since you've been on the show, but, you know, there's been so much going on, and particularly you touched on some really neat option strategies in your recent pieces, and I thought we'd bring you back and so we could pick your brain on different ways to implement different option strategies in this environment. So you just actually released a Convexity Maven piece titled "With a Mighty Hand and an Outstretched Arm." Those of our listeners that want to read the piece, we are going to link it in our research roundup email. Now, in here, you touch on a whole wave of different things, but I wanted to just right off the bat start off with the S&P 500, which was toward the bottom end of your piece. And you talked there about this idea of putting on this risk reversal trade on the S&P. So why don't you first talk us through just very quick summary of why your thesis is about the S&P potentially having some upside and why this is a really interesting way of implementing the trade.
You know, it does seem crazy to be bullish on any equity, financial asset right now, with the unemployment still very high and, you know, the virus still, early stages of the pandemic. But the reality is the Fed is going to be printing money. They've run at a 65%, expansion rate. and they're buying everything. And so I'm just going to not fight the Fed and say they're going to keep pumping money into the system. And therefore, I kind of want to get long. And how do you get long? You could buy stocks outright. What I said is to put a risk reversal where you buy an out-of-the-money call and sell an out-of-the-money put for basically a zero cost. When the market was at 3,000, 300 on the SPY, you can go out 2.5 years, which is great. It's listed. It's very liquid. You could buy the 350 call, 340 call, which is the old high. You could sell with 230 put, which I've gone through in my piece, the math on that, for zero cost. I would not say this is a hedge fund leveraged spec trade. I would say it's an asset replacement trade. It's a better beta trade. So if you already own equity exposure, which I'm sure you do, this is a much better way to gain that exposure than owning stocks outright.
Yeah, I do really like it. I mean, it's a zero cost, and your starting delta is about 70 cents on the dollar of the combination of the two, and you got some gamma on the trade. But what immediately caught me on the trade was, and I wanted your opinion on this, because instinctually, when I look at this trade, and I'm thinking about the notional dollar exposure, if I held to maturity, it doesn't match, because in the end, you're either going to, let's say the SPYs, you get in the money on the call at 340, you're going to call in $34,000 of S&P exposure, or at least you have the notional exposure on the upside. But if the put is being put to you at 230, you're only being assigned $23,000 of stock on the S&P. What do you think of the idea of matching the notional assignment where, let's say, for every two calls that you buy, you sell three puts? Do you like that idea, or what would I be missing on sizing the trade that way?
Well, I mean, you could do any kind of combination you want, and these trades work very well because of the skew and because the forward price is downward sloping. Because of the inversion of the dividend rate versus the borrow rate, I kind of think I'd be loving the idea of owning 3-2 on that trade. Really, I'm thinking about it's an asset replacement, it's a better beta. And if you own stocks when they get down to a lower level, you own less of them. That's the convexity of equities, is that when you think about it, the most you could lose is 100%, but you could make 2, 3, 4, 10 times. And this trade is very interesting in the sense that you have this stocks, equities, which are long convexity effectively, and you're buying a call option above it. So you're buying options on options. It's a very convex trade. And on the downside, if you own stocks right now at 3,100 and they drop 10, 20%, you lose one for one. In this trade here, although the mark to market would go against you initially, at the end of the day, you're not long stocks until down at 230. Which is why it's a better avenue. The way you lose on this trade, in theory, is we rally only 3 or 5, 10%, and you never cross the upside strike. And if you'd owned the assets, you would have made that small amount of money. That's a pretty small window to assume we're going to be there 2.5 years from now. We're going to be higher or lower. And the option market's already telling you that with the VIX near 30. We're not going to be here in 2.5 years.
Right. Now, earlier in the article, you touched on mortgage REITs. And first of all, I'd love to just hear you give a quick summary of your thesis on mortgage REITs. But when I was reading it, the first thing I thought of was back many months ago, you published the AMLP trade, and you used a very similar style strategy of selling a put and buying a call on the upside. And I was thinking, well, would that work on Annaly or some other mortgage REIT in that scenario? And so if you could first just start off with your bigger thesis and then just comment on whether or not this is a good fit for that type of an option strategy.
Sure. Most REITs that you read about are property REITs, they're equity REITs, they're people buying assets and putting them into a structure. A mortgage REIT is very different. It's where you're basically buying bonds, mortgages on residential property. Mostly for the big ones, Annaly or AGNC, they're buying Fannie and Freddie bonds. There is no credit risk. And right now the Fed is supporting that market by buying them, you know, once a month. They buy these mortgage, Fannie, Freddie, Ginny assets. They hedge them out with swaptions, maybe 5-1, 8-1, 10-1. And they're creating right now a 10, 11% dividend. I find it incredible to have a 10% yielding asset with no credit risk versus a, you know, 0.65 10-year. So I think it's a great cash flow investment that's relatively safe. If you had crazy volatility, I guess it could be a problem, but not too much. As to the what you've suggested, you're spot on right. The options price off of the forward, not the spot price. And when you have a, call it 10, 11% dividend right now versus a 1% cost of funds, the forward price is going to be down about 10% per year as you go on out. And so you could create structures where you actually buy calls struck under today's current price and sell much further out of the money puts for zero cost. Now you're giving up the dividend because you're embedding that dividend into the option structure, but it's not a bad strategy at all. You got to be careful to make sure that the options are pricing correctly, but in general, you are spot on right with the concept.
Well, touching back on that AMLP, has your position or opinion about that space changed at all, or do you still think it's an opportunity? Do you still think that there's room to put on a trade even at these lower levels on that AMLP?
AMLP is very interesting right now. I will say it has not worked as expected. There's an oil component. There's a credit component. Our sector is cheap, but I would not be adding to it. I'm holding what I have right now. Some of the calls on AMLP are inexpensive. For that particular asset, I would do the calls only and not sell the puts. They will be very cheap versus the value of the asset because they have a very high coupon on that ETF. And it's very liquid also, which is very helpful.
Right. So what I wanted to leave the conversation or the last topic to touch on is taking into account today's volatility conditions. Now, we've covered in past episodes this idea of going long volatility with things like back spreads. But when we were having a conversation, you were pointing out some of the volatility risks in these heightened volatile periods that could sting you in a period where volatility could normalize. And so I wanted you to just comment on today's volatility conditions in the options market in general. And what is the strategy that is in these types of market conditions ideal for the type of volatility we are seeing in the markets?
Back spreads or 2x1s, as I refer to them, great idea. But they're really well suited for when vol is low. The VIX is low. The VIX at 12, it's a home run to go and sell one option and buy twice as many because you're getting long optionality at a low implied vol. Right now, the VIX at 30.
And long vega, right? And so you're getting that kicker of the volatility works in your favor, right?
Exactly. With the VIX at 30 and the long-term average at 21, I'm not loving owning two options at 30 versus only being short one of them. It requires an awful lot of management to make that trade work. It can be a winner, but it requires a lot more management. The trade I love right now is basically specifically selling on SPY, selling the 240 put for October, and buying a 225 put for December. Ordinarily, in an option, options on SPY, the term surface points up. So a longer dated option has a higher implied vol. Also, the skew points, I guess, down up. A more out of the money put has a higher vol. So a longer maturity, lower strike option should trade to a much higher implied volatility than a shorter option. I could sell the 240 in October, buy the 225 in December, basically flat vol right now, which is rather impressive. Trade costs about a point and change, point and 10, point and 15. And on top of just the ordinary surface being, you know, kind of interesting for me, I'm short October, I'm long December. This trade carries very well. We could stay up or down, up 10%, down 20% from now to September, October. And this trade will actually lose no value at all because of the decay pattern. And if things go really haywire, you know, I own that downside put at a very cheap price. You do have the risk, in theory, of losing 15 points because you're short the 240 and long the 225. That's possible. I see it very unlikely that we're going to make new lows before the election.
I was about to say, you mentioned the election. I thought it was really interesting that it's almost like an election play because the one option will roll off before the results of the election and you have the other one long through the election. I mean, was that in your thought process when you were picking those two?
That's exactly my thought. I mean, I basically get to own the election risk. I won't say for free, but the trade is positive carry. We don't move. This package goes up in price. So you think about that, you get to own positive carry to own the election. This election, I guess it could be something, it could be simple, but I don't think so. It's already pretty rough and it's going to get rougher, you know, after the summer.
Harley, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your day to join us right before the long weekend to talk options. But great insights. Thank you very much, and we look forward to having you back on the show in the future.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Charlie, as well as the chart book that he shared throughout the interview. You'll also find a link to the Harley Bassman article we discussed here in the postgame. There's also an interesting article from Variant Perception about the U.S. recession, maybe shorter than expected, and a link to an article from Bill Blaine putting perspective on Tesla and other automakers. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @macrovoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSeresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Seresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.